It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Well, to learn more about food and farmers, we've had scores of conversations with farmers and people who want to be farmers, but none quite like the conversation we're going to have today with a successful 100-year-old farmer. Our guest is Jack Wolf, the patriarch of a highly regarded Fresno County wolf farming. Jack, I think we're making history. To my knowledge, this is the first podcast ever with a 100-year-old farmer. You've accomplished two things that I've learned many aspire to. You built a farm that has supported your family and hundreds of team members and supported the community, and you've lived 100 years, so congratulations.
Thank you.
Good to have you on Farm to Table Talk. I'm introducing you to podcasts, too. Jack, you know what? One of the first things I want to start off with, before we get into the whole farming thing, is the being 100. That's something a lot of us would like to do. You got any secrets to share with us on how to get to 100?
Well, I don't know that I have any particular secrets. Someone asked me somewhat the same question over the party we had here. And I don't know that I'm aware that I did anything. Fortunately, I think, if I look back, my wife was kind of health conscious, so we always kind of ate what we're supposed to eat. And fortunately, I'm a good sleeper, and so I always needed at least 8 hours, and no more recently, it's moved up to 9 hours. And I sleep well.
When Jack, you used to walk a lot too, didn't you?
And I walked a lot.
You know, I remember hearing stories of, I don't know, quite a few years ago, that you would get up and go, I don't know, maybe a couple miles to the coffee shop when you meet with people before.
I didn't go to the coffee shop. I had some friends that were also walking. And one was I had two friends in particular that I would meet, and we would start walking at about 5:45, and I would get out, and we walked about 5 miles every morning.
Well, how long ago did you start doing that? How many would have been 30 years ago or so?
Probably near 50 years ago.
Well, you know, that's something for all of us that are wearing our Apple watches now, trying to get in 10,000 steps a day. You were 50 years ahead of us in getting that walking, and I'm sure it pays off. I'm sure genetics has something to do with it, too. But, you know, I want to talk about the diet piece a minute, because have you ever seen this book called about the Blue Zones, where the places in the world where there are the most 100-year-old people?
No, I've kind of heard of that. But I have not read it.
You got to go there. We'll have to get those cities outlined for you, because they'll think you're a kid. So if you're starting to feel old, you need to go to one of these places and hang out, because there's a lot of people over 100. But there's only about 4 or 5 of them, I think, that are featured in the whole world. The only one in the United States is down around Loma Linda and in Southern California. And it's pretty much a Seventh-day Adventist area. So everybody not everybody, but mostly they tend to be vegetarian or very plant-focused and non-alcohol. I've seen you eat big steaks, and I've seen you enjoy your wine. So apparently you haven't cut back on some of those things. They can fit into your diet.
Well, I guess I have cut back a little bit. I told someone I usually always enjoyed that second glass of wine, and now I find that one glass kind of takes care of me.
Well, I can live with that. If I could get to be 100, I can cut back to one glass of wine. I mostly do now, I have to admit. But other than that, you were saying eating pretty healthy. You've always done, you know, vegetables.
Fortunately, I've had pretty good health.
Yeah. Well, and like I said, I mean, genetics have something to do with it, too. I would imagine if you got good genes and you walk for 50 years and you're eating well and sleeping well, and those all add up. So I'm willing to try to sign up for that plan.
You are.
You know, now let's go to Jack. I want to go to the farming thing. Now, you grew up in Arizona, didn't you?
I grew up in Arizona, outside of Phoenix, about 15 miles to the northwest of Phoenix, kind of halfway between the community of Glendale and Peoria.
Now, were you
on Lateral 20 and Northern Avenue.
Now, were you on a farm or a ranch?
It was a farm of about 200 acres.
What can you do with 200 acres of desert in Arizona?
Well, my father was had some financial issues, problems in the early 1920s. And so then the farm depression actually started in long 1921, 22, in that period of time.
So it preceded the Big Depression.
And they preceded the Big Depression. And then the Big Depression comes along. And so my father went the dairy route. He acquired four or five Jersey cows, and we just kept building the herd up. And when, during my high school years, I milked 20 cows every morning and 20 cows every evening. And that was, and my twin brother, likewise.
My gosh, so that was, I mean, those are the days you actually were having to put your hands on the cows. You didn't, you just weren't just hooking up machines.
Strange thing, my father always told why those electric milkers would not be good for a cow. And then when we left to go to college, he bought an electric milker.
Well, that's, isn't that something? And that was quite a ways ago. I didn't know that they were using electric milkers back in the 20s.
Well, certainly they've improved them a lot.
So somewhere in there, Jack, when you were having to get up and milk 20 cows, what time in the morning did you say that was?
I would get up every morning by 5 o'clock.
So didn't it occur to you there must be an easier way to make a living than being a farmer?
Well, at that time, I said I would not be a farmer.
I kind of got to the same stage, and then I stuck with it. But you, not long after, you went into college then? Did you start taking some
courses? Well, I went to college, and I wanted, in those days, jobs were difficult to get.
Right.
And so I was aware of Anderson Clayton being a cotton brokerage company, and they also did crop financing for growers. I was aware of them growing up, mm-hmm. and they headquartered for the West was in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. and that's where I'd gone to college, a business college. And so I called on them and called on them and called on them, and one day to get rid of me, they hired me.
So what the hell do you do?
Well, I just was a, they had fancy titles, but I was more or less a clerk. During cotton harvest, where they were grading cotton, I worked there as the one that record what the classers call made on the samples. And then there was a, after the cotton harvest, there was handling the cotton seed in the crushing facility. And they were just reports that needed to come in. And so that was my assignment at that time.
You know, there's some people listening to this that probably have a hard time realizing life before calculators and let alone computers. And so I would imagine you used a pencil and a ledger for a lot of this information that you were working on.
That we did.
That's a lot of writing. At the same time, when you're in the middle of doing all of that, you're connected with cotton farming because you're pushing pencils and on these ledgers. But it, were you thinking then, I want to be a farmer sometime, or was it still kind of a distant idea?
That was not my agenda at that time.
Well, then the next agenda, somewhere down the road in not too many years, we had a war. And
we had World War II come along prior to the Pearl Harbor, the draft, and I was caught in the second draft. And so in kind of May of 1941, I was drafted and went to a place near La Jolla, California, called Camp Callan. And that's where I went to do the 90-day stint. And while there, I had a older friend that came by to see me, and he was a retired Navy person. And he said, "Jack, get down there and apply for officer school. There's going to be a war." And I thought, he doesn't know that I get out in about 6 months. And so I didn't do anything. But on his way back from wherever he had gone, a month later, he came and persuaded me that was something I should do. So I went in and applied for officer school. They gave IQ tests of a broad questionnaire, and I aced that somehow.
Did you cheat?
Just luck.
You weren't copying the neighbor or anything?
No, I wasn't.
Okay.
At any rate, I was accepted as a candidate for officers, and it was Camp Callan was a Coast Artillery school. Mm-hmm. And anyway, nothing really happened. And I thought they were going to kick me out of there before I went to officer school. And then Pearl Harbor comes along. And about a week later, I got notified to go to Camp Davis in North Carolina.
And you ended up in Europe. And you were and you were in the battles there, and you had, and what was your responsibility? What was your office?
Well, I was the captain at that time of a battery in an anti-aircraft battalion.
So these are people then that were shooting the anti-aircraft guns, and they were where on the coast of, was France and Belgium or North Africa?
Well, we were lined up. So happened one of the, I still have a copy of my orders that I received at Weymouth Harbor in 1944, a notice that told me to get my unit ready and with all this preparation and so forth for a water debarkation. And 8 hours after the first troops landed, we were to follow. They were going to have a, engineers had a bunch, a vast number of steel, or may have been aluminum, planks, so fighter aircraft could land wherever they landed. We landed so they could refuel. And the luck of the draw is I drew Omaha Beach. And our orders originally were to get off 8 hours after the first soldier landed at Omaha. As you well know, they had some difficulty there.
And we were parked, wasn't it, or?
Behind a battleship,
yeah,
for an extra 24 hours.
Wow.
And then we did land, and we found our way to our assigned site. The engineers, they, by that time, they'd pushed in 5 or 6 or 7 miles and taken over a German airport. And so then one that they were going to build that we were to defend, it never was built.
You know, and you go through the war. You were there. How many years were you over? In
2 years.
2 years. And Jack, and you had this responsibility. I was just curious. Did you get to know? Did you have any farm kids that were with you in that in your group over there?
Not that I was aware that. And that was not a question we would be asking.
Well, no, I'm just curious. I mean, when you're in the middle again, you're over there. You're in the middle of World War II and all the horrible things that go with a raging war. Did you ever have any thoughts then of what you were going to do when you got home? I mean, when you weren't thinking about all that the war made you think about, were you thinking, boy, if I ever get out of this thing, I'm going to go back home, and I'm going to do this.
One way or the other, I told myself I wanted to work for myself and not go back to Anderson Clayton. Well, when the war finally got over and I got home, I looked around, and, of course, I ended up with a bank account that had about $5,000, which went away pretty fast, and so I've found my way back to Anderson Clayton.
You got to be careful when you say never, right?
That's right.
And so you got back to them. You're back in the cotton business again. Now you're doing all these things. When did it start occurring to you that there still might be something different? What would make you think about the next stage then?
Well, at that time of my life, I wanted to have a job, but kind of paid a little bit more than what I originally had started out with. And I know today it seems strange, but most folks got about $200 to $300 a month in those days. Mm-hmm. And Anderson Clayton found they didn't know what to do, really, in one way with the returning warriors. They felt they had to give them a job, but during the war, they found that women were smarter than they thought they were, and they didn't want, and they worked, believe it or not, for a few bucks less than what they were paying us, and so they didn't want to let the women go, and they were making up jobs for those of us that had returned from the war. My job was to go between the various places that they had a cotton mill, a cotton seed mill, storage, where they were crushing the seed, and I was to record and come up with the tonnage and that sort of thing.
So you get out, and you were at the cotton farms. Were they in California or Arizona or Texas?
Arizona and California.
Okay. And then as you're moving around there, were you ever seeing it in the eyes that you could thought you were going to be a cotton farmer someday?
Not that day. Not at that time. I was in Mexicali, where they had a large cotton seed crushing plant, and I got a call to go and meet with a man by the name of Russell Giffen. They had purchased his farm. And but however it came about, they needed data on serial numbers of equipment and water wells and that sort of thing. And I was asked to move to west of Mendota and look up Mr. Giffen and get that data and provide it to the office in Los Angeles.
Well, they'll tell people where that is. Where's Western Mendota?
Do what?
Or where do you say that was that you had to move to?
I moved from Mexicali, where I was just temporarily there,
right,
to west of Mendota.
And where is that?
Mendota is out of Fresno, California, about 30 miles west.
What do you do? Did you get a house or an apartment there?
Out on the Giffen Ranch, there was a one-room accommodation, and that's where I was.
Have indoor plumbing?
And so I went to the three ranches that they have owned, and after about 30 days, I went in to tell Mr. Giffen goodbye. And he said, Jack, why don't you just stay here? And that was it seemed like a permanent tag down on a farm that I found that I kind of enjoyed because I had that background. And I said yes.
And from that, Jack, I know you then ended up evolving into years of working with the Giffens.
I worked for just over 30 years. And I became the business manager. And I bought thousands of acres of land and leased thousands of acres every year. The ranch became... Mr. Giffen moved from that ranch and started a new ranch, and I went with him. And the new ranch, known as Giffen Incorporated, or Giffen Inc., ended up having just over 120,000 acres.
That's big. I mean, that's big in any time, but it was certainly big back then. It's still really big today. And of those, how many different crops would you have grown on those?
Well, cotton was a backbone crop, but they also grew, we call that the summer crop, cotton, and some cantaloupes, primarily cotton. And then the winter crop was barley in those days. And a little limited acreage of flax, but mostly barley.
Well, that's changed a lot, hasn't it? I mean, how come in that same area there must be 30, 40 different crops grown in that area now?
Well, I don't know if it's 30 or 40, but there's a lot of crop, and it's become particularly known for almonds and pistachios and tomatoes.
Yeah, in those days with all that acreage, did you have farmers you worked with that would rent from you or operate the different plots? And how did you manage that much acreage with them?
On the 120, we were broken up at three different locations, one at Huron, and then about 25 miles to the northwest was the Cantua, C-A-N-T-U-A. Mm-hmm. And then another 30 miles up was the Enterprise Ranch.
You know, and in that, again, in that capacity, you were looking at the business of farming through that period of time. What was working, what wasn't working.
Absolutely.
And while you were there, did you come to any conclusions about the either relationships with the customers, with how you were marketing your cotton or the cantaloupes or something? I'm just curious whether in that process you're coming to some conclusions about how this works out for farmers versus everybody else in the middle.
Well, I was, as a business manager, one of the things I did, had to do, was sell the crops. So I had a close relationship with all the cotton merchants in the area, and that was the heyday for California cotton. And on the tomatoes, I, of course, was the one that made the contract with the Heinz and the Contadinas and the folks like that.
And in those days, back with the tomatoes, for example, that was really before they had the tomato harvesters, wasn't it? Was it hand picked for the processing?
We had 3 years, 2 years, where we hand picked every processing tomato, and then someone came along with a what they call the black welder mechanical harvester. And that's before they had tinkered with the tomato itself to toughen the skin. After you went through the field, it looked like the field was bleeding. The tomatoes were soft. But anyway, that was part of the evolution of tomato.
There must have had to be hundreds of people in the field when you were needing to get all those fresh.
Thousands.
Thousands in the fields. My goodness. Now, as in the years that went on, there came a stage where it became clear that the only way you could farm on the west side, the Central Valley of California, is to have access to water. And the water laws changed, and there was difficult for companies as big as yours was, that many acreage, to get all the water allowances.
Because we had started out with water wells, but the water well tables were going down a little bit every year. And so that was a move, and successful move, to have Bureau of Reclamation, a federal project, bill, and we would get water out of Shasta, have it move through the Delta channels, and had a canal that was built, and then a distribution system, all of that was built as well.
Yeah, and that's, for people that don't know, Shasta is probably 250, 300 miles north of where your farm was, and had to go down the irrigation canals. You ended up creating a farming, company.
Part of the reclamation project was that the large landowners could get water for 10 years, but then they had to sell and reduce their farm to 160 acres per person. And so all sorts of deals began to emerge, as you might assume. So happened we had six children, and we made a trust, so each one of my kids' children could own 160. My wife could own 160, and myself 160. My twin brother 160, and on down. It was ways that you tried to build up the size that you could farm. Most folks in that day accepted the fact that on the western Fresno County, you needed to have about 2,500 acres as a minimum size farm. And so that persisted. And so most operations were at least 2,500 acres.
Does that continue today? Is it still, to how much water you have access today, still tied to these operational either family units or trusts that limit how much can be available to you?
Well, the law was changed along in the 80s, and that was moved up to 960 acres per family. Now, we didn't write the law, but it meant that if you had a trust and you had a person that was 1 month old, you could own 960. I know it sounds crazy. So I had 24 grandchildren, which meant they could each own 960. And then my wife and I together could have 960.
You know, this is, it's an incredible story, and you could get up to the scale again, and you've been able then to build this farming operation. And when a lot of this was happening, Jack, you were what, in your 50s or early 60s when you were doing most of this?
First of all, let's go back to Russell Giffen.
Sure, okay.
So it was the Giffen Inc. operated, was recognized as one of the top organization, farmer organization in the world. And Mr. Giffen told me one day that two heart attacks and a light stroke were all the warnings one man was entitled to, and he wanted to liquidate. Mm-hmm. And he said he wouldn't be able to do it, and he gave me that assignment to sell off the 120,000 acres. I went back to him the next morning and told him that Bernice and I, my wife Bernice, and I would like to buy some of that. And he smiled and he said nothing would please him more, but he still wanted cash. And so that limited you a little bit to what you could do, because my cash was just somewhat limited. But we were able to buy from Giffen Inc. 1,320 acres of fee or owned land and about 7,000 acres of leases. And that started our Wolf Farming Company.
So, you know, people listening to this, Jack, that are from other places in the country, like I am from a farm in central Illinois, they have a hard time getting their getting their mind around the scale and the water rules and how you had to work. But it's just so much different. I mean, I grew up in an area where when I was young, a typical farm was, you know, maybe 100 acres, and every quarter of a mile you would see this, you know, picket fence around a white house and a red barn and some cows and some pigs, and you know, that it's a real different situation for people to relate to, this kind of scale of farming and the issues that you faced out here in California. I mean, you are even, you know, to this day, you know, a really large farming company, but you've got a lot of people that you've been able to get into agriculture. They have come to work with you. You're not only supporting your family, you're supporting a whole lot of other families and communities with this business.
Well, the Giffen operation was broken up into 42 different new farms. The smallest was an acre and a quarter. And, of course, we were kind of like 8,000 acres. Was kind of, we were among the larger ones. And then as we started farming, we had some luck, I call it, because we had a period of time where we were very tight financially, and we hit and aced a couple of tomato crops where we just did extremely well, far beyond our fondest dreams. We hit that number, and that gave us a leg up. Having done that, then we just began to farm, look at our neighbors. And during the purchase from Giffen Inc., some of them were clearly entrepreneurs that thought they could pick up some land, hold it about 10 years, and sell it for a profit. And so having that attitude in that area enabled us to buy some of those as the years went along.
I've kept a large number of people employed year-round.
Yes, we did. We had about 300 people that we kept employed. Now, some of those were folks that were more seasonal, like weeders and that sort of thing. But we had about 100 that were year-round on the payroll.
In your program, too, you started figuring out the need that you had to expand from just producing. What caused you to do that?
Well, we just thought there was a need. We, among the crops that we planted in 1974 is when we purchased, we also put out 640 acres of almond trees. And we found that we did reasonably well with the almonds and planted some more. And we were not alone. Some of our neighbors also did the same. There seemed to be a need. We were shipping our almonds to be processed maybe 200 miles away, and it just seemed like we could do it ourselves. So we built, had a neighbor join us, John Harris, and we formed what we call Harris Wolf Almond Processing and built an almond processing facility.
And then you did the same thing happened with the tomato plant.
Tomatoes. We had a close association with several of the major processors, particularly Heinz. And their field man would come along in the early winter months when you had to make your plans of planting and tell us that the timing that they wanted us to ship tomatoes to their facility. And so I dropped the seed in the ground, and everything was moving along. But they would tag me and say, we want those tomatoes starting on, say, June 28th. We want your first loads coming in. Well, with the variables that you have with weather, some years we made that, and then some years you went back to them and said everything was delayed, rains, whatever. You needed to set that date up. And one year, I went and met with their California field man, and he agreed that we'd move it up 2 weeks. I asked him to give me a letter on that, and the letter never came. And when the 1st of July came, he said, I got to tell you, we won't be able to take them 2 weeks down the road. We need them now. And they weren't ready. The upshot was that I plowed up about 500 acres of tomatoes. Didn't harvest one. And I thought that day, I can't farm on that sort of a schedule. And then I began to think about a tomato processing facility. We visited around with the folks that are in that sort of a thing and found that we needed to pull together about $20 million. And so I went to some neighbors and asked him if he didn't join me. We would have half, 50%, when the other, I wanted a neighbor to have 1/6 and 1/6 and 1/6. And I found those neighbors joined us, and we started Los Gatos Tomato Products.
We ought to explain, Jack, that some people wonder about, you know, processed tomatoes or fresh tomatoes and so forth. But what you were doing was that you were taking tomatoes that otherwise could rot in the field if your market didn't come through for you, if, as happened in that case, and you could take them and you could seal them and turn them into paste that would be preserved. So these big bins of paste, and which takes some of the water out and heat and clean them and so forth, and then sell them to people making spaghetti sauce and pizza sauce
and
soup and juice and ketchup and ship it back. And the other interesting thing I find, Jack, is that in those cases, you actually take the water out of them here at your plant and ship them to somewhere where it has more water, and they can, you might be able to reuse the water you kept here in California, and then they add water sometimes, and adding salsa and juice and ketchup and so forth. But you eliminated some of the risk, because when you've got these bins to sell, they last for a long time, whereas those tomatoes in the field,
it's sterile.
They're good until they start rotting.
Yeah.
Took things into your own hands and turned them around. What do you feel best about when you talk about your relationship with your neighbors?
Well, we had... We had good neighbors, and I like to think that if you're a good neighbor, you in turn have a good neighbor. My neighbor to the south is Mike Dressick. He grows some tomatoes. He's primarily in the lettuce and cantaloupe. He's the neighbor that I can call up and tell him, you're harvesting cantaloupe, and you haven't given me my crate load. I want a few crates of melon through the season. And so we have a great relationship. I think we cultivated that, and they respond to that as well.
You guys are all putting the straws deep into the same glass. If you look at, in addition to the surface water you're getting, there is well water out there.
There is
well
water.
So does that become an issue, that you ever feel like there's neighbors that are pulling more than their share out of the aquifer that's under you?
No, that is not an issue with us. We know that we have water wells. And first of all, we're all in a water district, and supposedly we were to get our supply out of from the Shasta and the canal system. When you have droughts, they don't have the water to give you, and we are somewhat dependent or supplemented, need the water wells. There's never been looking over the fence at your neighbor, what he's pumping versus what you're pumping. That just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And I think maybe because of the relationship we have with one another.
Well, Jack, you have 6 kids. They're 4 boys and 2 girls, and I think two of them are directly involved in the company today. One's a CEO, one's more in the tomato side of the business. They're all connected. They're all on your
They all have ownership.
And then they have, what, is it 24 grandchildren?
24 grandchildren.
And of all of that clan that you've got and their connection with farming on the west side, have you been surprised as how some of them have shown an interest in farming and agriculture? And
well, they all indicate. Now, my two daughters, I'm not talking about, I'm talking more about my four sons. Mm-hmm. One daughter lives in Santa Cruz, mm-hmm. And other daughter is married to a appellate court judge. And while they have an interest in wolf farming, I'm talking about the girls, have an interest, their husbands are not involved.
Right.
Now, my four sons, my oldest son, John, is in citrus farming, but he also has a little jag of almonds and pistachios and mandarin oranges. That's his number one big thing. It doesn't sound like as many acres, but he has a couple of thousand acres of that and does very well for himself. Son Mike is a practicing dentist, but on the side he has, let me think, 2,300 acres of pistachios and 800 acres of almonds. And he's truly an entrepreneur guy all by himself, plus the interest that he has in wolf farming company. Our youngest, let's see, I've covered, Stuart, number three, third son, had a business education and marketing, and he has ended up as the CEO of Wolf Farming Company and Processing. He's over everything. And then the youngest son, Chris, has a nursery where he grows almond trees, believe it or not, and also sells tomato paste for Los Gatos.
And then you, of those 24 grandchildren, I think you've maybe by now, at least one's been through law school and one's a doctor, I think, and one's, but you've got one that studies soil science. You've got a couple that, I know when they went back and were working on the farm, set up community gardens for the, and were involved when you were establishing out on the farm. Community gardens. You've had somebody that was in the what's called woofing, the worldwide opportunities in organic farming, and worked on our organic farm in Florida. And someone that went down and spent time working, I think, in Nicaragua on, you know, helping fair trade and coffee. Well, I want to point that out, Jack, because I think a lot of people are surprised that large-scale farming, as you've been a large-scale farming, they wonder about the second generation of millennials. And you cover the spectrum in your family of everything, like I say, from helping out on an organic farm to free trade to who knows what to, you know, wolf farming itself and community gardens.
It's, out of 24 grandchildren, 14 are boys. And One grandchild is a practicing attorney, and he came to his uncle Stuart and said that he'd like to be involved in the farm. So he's now living in Fresno, and he's a full-time attorney representing Wolf Farming Company. We have, now I probably need to address Wolf Farming Company a little bit more. We have moved along, and we've planted lots of pistachios. We have considerable acreage of almonds. But during the drought, we found that we needed more. Let's start by almonds need the best water you can find. Versus pistachios can use any kind of water. We laugh and say you can tie a dog to the pistachio tree and it makes out. But almonds have to have good water. And in the drought, they reduced our delta water to zero. And so Stuart Wolf has embraced on leading Wolf Farming Company into long-term leases on the east side of the valley. There are 25-year leases where we plant almonds for the landowner. We give them a 1/12 share crop, and we put up all the money, and we grow. So we're growing most of our almonds on the east side now. And we have about 6,000 acres there.
It's interesting. I mean, you know, people that, like your experience in your own family, that get education, including up to a law degree, and then want to come back and be attached to agriculture.
Well, we have Ross as an attorney, and he's very much in all those crop share leases and all that. We have a another grandson that has gone to school in Australia for whatever reason, but he's back, and Matt is asking questions. He wants to get a piece of land and start farming some crops, specialty crops. He talks about heirloom tomatoes and so forth, but I can see he's coming down that way. We have a Nancy's son, Philip, is in soil science, and he works there, has been now for about 12 years.
Well, and there's a lot of people listening to this podcast I know are concerned about the quality of soil. And I'm curious, in your 100 years perspective, and you haven't that long in California, but in California, we've got nearly, 60, 70 years in California or so. Do you think the soil has been degraded? I mean, there's people that worry about that, that feel like we're not taking as good a care of the soil.
No, I would not agree with that. There's just no question that we have knowledge about it, a way to test it, and we have, we formed a company, and one of the growers that, there's about five farmers bought into a company that tests the leaves for content and the soil on a continuing basis, and we feed that back whatever we need, whatever ingredients those tests show.
So if we went back 50 years ago or so, and if you had, say, gone out with a spade and dug a core sample of that soil in West Fresno County, and then we went and did the same thing today and put them side by side and analyzed them, it would be just as good today as it was then, you think?
I think you would find that it's not, we're not wasting it. We're not, it would be very comparable.
One thing, I had some other farmers tell me down in Ventura County that he's pretty sure the soil's better than it was when the Spanish were here because they weren't.
They didn't know about replacing the minerals and so forth.
Well, not only that, but they weren't irrigating, and so it was pretty much almost like desert if you didn't put water on it, and so you didn't have the organic matter. And so the organic matter from the crop residues has been added over the years.
That's right.
And then you still have, for the most part, you have rotation, although you're not rotating these pistachio plants that you're putting in because, I mean, they're going to, maybe these new trees I hear could be in for 100 years, perhaps.
Well, the pistachios are the one exception.
Yeah, and so you don't get to rotate. People talk about a monoculture. Well, that's just the way it's going to be with the trees. I mean, trees don't come out every year, but you still are managing for that quality. And I kind of interrupted you though, but you were mentioning your grandson that's studying soils. Sure. And but I had to point out he's the one that had a bet with you or a challenge. And he had this, some of my listeners could really appreciate it. He had this great head of dreadlocks.
Dreadlocks
while he was working on his master's.
And I took him to lunch about 3 years ago, and I said, what the heck? Why the dreadlocks? When is that? And he said, when you reach 100, we'll cut them off. And so I've dropped him a note about every 6 months. And I'd tease him and tell him that I wasn't feeling just tip-top and maybe we ought to move that up. Well, it so happened, nothing happened until my birthday came. And I called him up and said, I've reached 100. And our agreement was they come off with 100. I want you here on Thursday at 11 o'clock. We're going to have a haircut. And so most of his cousins were aware of that bet, and they came, and I cut them off.
You cut them off?
I cut them off.
Oh, Jack, you know what? I think you ought to really show everybody now. Now, you ought to be the first 100-year-old to grow dreadlocks yourself. You could start now. Well, I tell you what, it's a fabulous story, and you provided leadership in agriculture, and you've got a lot to show for 100 years, more than just 100 years. You've accomplished a lot. You've helped the family. There are people, and I can tell you that I've seen so many people that aren't related to you that believe that you've helped them. They benefited from your leadership and your guidance, and we're thankful for that, Jack. And I have to ask you, I mean, two things. I think one is when you look a little backwards at these last 50, 60, 70, 80 years almost, but touching agriculture, what gives you the most satisfaction with what you've done with this career connected with agriculture? What makes you feel best about your
career? Well, as corny as it may sound, is to go out and see a stand of cotton coming through the ground or a tomato crop that just nothing, just loaded down with tomatoes. It's great. Or an almond crop or a pistachio crop. And today, obviously, Stuart has a superintendent and who in turn has foremen that are chasing it on a daily basis. And today, at my age, all I do is kind of drive around.
Well, you drive around and you look and you ask questions and you stay interested and you still ask good questions. And I also know that you're still an optimist about the future. I mean, you are, even at 100, you're making suggestions about the farming operation for the next 100 years. You know, like the decisions on putting pistachios in that will be in the ground for 100 years. I mean, when you're looking ahead now as a 100-year-old, but looking into the future, what gives you the most optimism about farming today?
Well, I think it's very bright. folks do continue to eat. And you can't substitute most of these foods. It has to be grown. So I think we have a role to play. Now, in our own case, we do have water issues of great concern. We need one way or the other to have that system revamped, reworked, so we can have a supply that we can count on year after year. That's a one critical item for us.
Well, and on that line, I've heard you say before that you've done things to be more and more efficient with your water already. I mean, you, and who knows what it's going to be in the future, but with some of your drip irrigation systems, you're putting less water on than you used to, and you're getting bigger crops because you're getting more precise.
Well, there's no question that the buried drip has been a revelation to us. You're doing watering that crop with at least one-third less water, and you're getting about two-thirds better yields. So it's a win-win on that. But I can't emphasize enough that we need, as a nation, to come up because they need this food supply.
They do, and they need constant improvement. You've had that, Jack. I think that when we hear talking about sustainability, I don't think there can be a better example of being sustainable than your farming operation over the years, because if you can improve the land, if you can improve the yield, if you can get more people involved, if you can support your family, if you can help your neighbors, if you can support the community, growing more food on using less resources and using them smarter, you epitomize sustainability in many, many ways. And I think we're just grateful, Jack, to have and continuing to enjoy your leadership and Wolf Farming's leadership. So happy birthday.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.